this week on Capitalism, Race, and Democracy.
The U.S. government is attempting to shred the First Amendment, the right to free speech, the right to freedom of the press, and freedom of association through the political persecution of Black-led organization that has advocated for the liberation of African people for nearly 60 years.
The free speech trial of the Uhuru Three is underway in Tampa, Florida.
Unless and until there is justice in Bhopal, unless and until this precedent is changed, we are all at risk of losing our health and our right to a healthy environment.
Survivors of Dow Chemical's 1984 environmental disaster in Bhopal, India, are now on a U.S. tour to press for action on corporate crime and build alliances with U.S. environmental justice groups.
The Kenyan troops, they are there to maintain control, to keep the status quo going. And so people in Haiti, we are very opposed to it. And I'm so glad that people in Kenya, in several countries in Africa, and in the Caribbean are standing with the Haitian people in opposition to this.
U.S.-funded Kenyan mercenary troops are currently on the ground in Haiti, the first Black republic to free itself from slavery 220 years ago.
There's a long history of collusion, illegal collusion, of land theft, apartheid, and now genocide against the Palestinians by the American labor movement as well as by the U.S. government.
U.S. healthcare workers have been mobilizing against the genocide in Gaza. From Pacifica Radio, this is Capitalism, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from Pacifica stations and affiliates across the U.S. I'm your host, Polina Vasilyev. On Tuesday, September 3rd, the Uhuru 3 trial began at the federal courthouse in Tampa, Florida. In April 2023, the U.S. Department of Justice indicted three leaders of the Uhuru movement: African People's Socialist Party Chairman Omali Yeshitela, African People's Solidarity Committee Chairwoman Penny Hess, and Uhuru Solidarity Movement Chair Jesse Neville, accusing them of acting as agents of Russia to sow discord in the U.S. Each of them faces a maximum prison sentence of 10 to 15 years on charges they vigorously deny as completely bogus. Uhuru 3 supporters spoke to the press before entering the courthouse to begin the trial. Here's Mwezi Odom, chair of the Hands Off Uhuru campaign.
Today begins the historic Uhuru 3 free speech trial of the century, where the U.S. government is attempting to shred the First Amendment, the right to free speech, the right to freedom of the press, and freedom of association through the political persecution of Black-led organization that has advocated for the liberation of African people for nearly 60 years. If convicted on these baseless charges that he is a secret pawn in the Russian government conspiracy to, quote, sow discord and interfere with elections, Chairman Omali, 82-year-old veteran of the civil rights and Black power movement, faces up to 15 years in prison, which is effectively a life sentence. This is a precedent-setting case that seeks to put an end to the constitutional protections of everyone's right to free speech, because it is the first time that a, quote, foreign agent law is being used to prosecute alleged crimes consisting exclusively of giving speeches, attending conferences, printing articles, and running for elected office. It is a continuation of the FBI's decades-long war on the Black movement, beginning with J. Edgar Hoover's career-launching campaign against Marcus Garvey through the, quote, Red Scare, and targeted such figures such as W.E.B. Du Bois and Paul Robeson, and most well-known in the COINTELPRO efforts to discredit and neutralize Black leaders in the 1960s, including Malcolm X, Martin Luther King, Huey P. Newton, and Fred Hampton. Chairman Omali Yeshitela began his political life in the 1960s in the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, also known as SNCC, registering Black voters, and went on to build the Uhuru Movement for African Liberation, initiating over 50 economic Black community institutions across the United States and Africa. In 5 decades, he has traveled to 19 countries to advocate for African unity and freedom. His published writings can be read in 55 years of the Burning Spear newspaper, available in the University of Florida's digital newspaper collection. In its April 2023 indictment of Chairman Omali Yeshitela and co-defendants Penny Hess and Jesse Neville, the government prosecutors cite that the Uhuru 3's call for reparations, their accusation of the U.S. genocide against Black people, and opposition to U.S. wars as evidence of quote-unquote foreign Russian control. This is a racist denial of Black people's agency. We can think for ourselves, and we define our own agenda. The indictment came 9 months later after the FBI's July 29, 2022 violent raids on 7 homes and offices of the Uhuru leaders in St. Louis, Missouri, and St. Petersburg, Florida, during which computers, phones, hard drives, and files were seized, but no arrests were made. This was the opening salvo in an escalating government campaign to silence dissent and end free speech for everyone. So first, I want to bring up Jill Stein, Green Party candidate for U.S. president, and she, along with many members and chapters of the Green Party, have been early and strong supporters of the Uhuru 3. Jill Stein herself was victimized with false allegations of being a Russian asset. Uhuru Jill.
Thank you all so very much for being here today. I'm here to help sound the alarm because that violent pre-dawn raid on Chairman Omali Asiatila's home and the draconian prosecution being conducted here today are a frontal assault on our democracy. Everyone who cares about democracy, about free speech, about the censorship silencing the genocide in Gaza, everyone concerned about the endless war machine now costing the average American household $12,000 this year alone, anyone who cares about the militarization of local police, the rise of cop cities, the role of the Israeli Defense Forces in training local police in the latest violent tactics, anyone who cares about the return of the draft and the automatic registration that's now happening for all men from 18 to 26 years old, whether you know it or not, and which will spring into action when U.S. troops are ordered into any of the several fronts of escalating conflict as we speak. If you care about any of those things, you need to be really alarmed about the attack on Omali Asiatila, Penny Hess, and Jesse Neville. This is a sequel to the attack on Julian Assange, and the empire does not want you to know about it. The mainstream press that crucified Julian Assange for years until the public forced the press to cover Assange accurately is conducting the same media blackout on this case. The attack on the Uhuru 3 is fundamentally an attack on free speech, on our right to oppose endless wars and economic oppression abroad, aka colonialism. It is an attack on our right to oppose the cost of these endless wars at home, namely economic austerity and the war on democracy. It is a cruel joke that the FBI and the DOJ are trying to cover up its latest attack on free speech as a response to a ludicrous conspiracy between peaceful, lifelong organizers and Russian nationals, accusing them all of attempting to sow discord and interfere in elections. This accusation ignores their lifelong history of activism and tries to disparage their deeply held beliefs as products of Russian propaganda. If the DOJ is looking for an illegal foreign agent, they need look no farther than AIPAC, which is throwing real money, $100 million in this election alone, into buying favors for a foreign government. No, now, where have we heard this narrative before? I myself was the subject of an effort to tie me to the bogus Russiagate narrative, which was used as a political cudgel in an effort to silence and intimidate the opponents of Hillary Clinton and the Democratic National Committee. This accusation has been thoroughly discredited, but tied me up for 3 years fighting a Senate Intelligence Committee investigation, accusing me of being a Russian asset. The Russiagate conspiracy theory was just a taste of the political repression that has grown much worse. In recent weeks and months, we've seen a very ominous surge in attacks on activists and journalists, including the recent attack on Sarah Wilkinson in the UK, Scott Ritter in the US, Richard Medhurst in the UK, the founder of Telegram, the new restrictions on campus protests that will make for explosive tensions on campus, with the American Association of University Professors issuing a recent statement condemning these overly restrictive policies that discourage free expression. At the University of Southern Florida, approval is now required for tents and canopies and banners and signs and amplifiers. The restrictions are outrageous. There are huge racial dimensions, overarching dimensions to the assault on the Uhuru 3, but no one should think that being white is a protection against resurgent fascism. Everyone is at risk in this assault on democracy, and we need to fight for the Uhuru 3 together. Democracy is on the line for all of us, and together we are unstoppable. Thank you very much.
The trial of the Uhuru 3 continues this week at the federal courthouse in Tampa, Florida. More information can be found at handsoffuhuru.org.
The system is a fraud. I said the system is a graveyard. And if you walk downtown at night, you feel for fuss and fight. And if you walk uptown, the people them frown. The system is a fraud. Some of them reach half a tree, them start to fret already. What a day when the pendulum swing, what a day when the well run dry, and the children ask you why. And the pit and the meat and we all live in it, and the game is the same, and who is to blame? The system is a fraud. And you listen to the news and you get confused, and you watch TV, it's the same thing. What a day when the pendulum swing.
That was Muta Baruka, The System. You're listening to Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm your host, Polina Vasilyev. Survivors of Dow Chemical's 1984 Bhopal, India gas explosion are on a U.S. tour to press for action on corporate crime and build alliances with U.S. environmental justice groups. Bob Lederer of WBAI Pacifica Radio in New York has more.
In the world's worst industrial disaster, extreme corporate negligence led to a devastating gas explosion in 1984 at a pesticides factory in Bhopal, India, then owned by Union Carbide, now Dow Chemical Company. Since the night of that disaster, over 25,000 people have been killed due to a chemical exposure and its aftermath, and over 500,000 remain seriously impacted by chronic health conditions, generational birth defects, and ongoing groundwater contamination in Bhopal. No Union Carbide or Dow officials were ever held criminally responsible, and the company only paid victims and families of those killed trivial amounts of compensation. Survivors of this corporate crime and organizers of the large-scale India-wide fight back are currently on a 17-stop U.S. tour to raise awareness and reinvigorate solidarity with Bhopal in the U.S., where Dow Chemical is based. During their U.S. visits, they are convening with numerous environmental justice organizations to highlight similarities between the struggles in India and in U.S. communities of color. They are also sharing stories on how Bhopalis have taken care of each other and maintained the struggle through 40 years of injustice. Last month, Jacqueline Batisse, producer of People of Earth, a program of indigenous voices on Pacifica station KPFT in Houston, interviewed Rachna Dhingra, coordinator of the International Campaign for Justice in Bhopal.
I work with survivors of the Union Carbide disaster that happened in Bhopal on the night of December 2nd and 3rd, 1984, which is not only known as the world's worst industrial disaster, but it's the deadliest corporate massacre in the history. So to tell your audience, this was a pesticide plant, being run by an American corporation called Union Carbide, and also now known as the Dow Chemical Company, which leaked about 27 tons of methyl isocyanate, a chemical which is 500 times more poisonous than hydrogen cyanide. And it killed about 8,000 to 10,000 people in the immediate aftermath. More than 25,000 people have died as a result of exposure-related illnesses, and more than 500,000 people are maimed for life and continue to live with consequences even 40 years later today. This is not something that happened 40 years ago. This continues to kill people. This continues to kill, disable the next generation even today. This is the third generation of birth defects, lasting economic consequences, and ongoing water contamination that continues to happen today. So, I mean, everyone might have heard about the disaster. I think a lot of people, they know where they were when they heard about this news. But very few people know that there is an a global toxic hotspot that continues to contaminate the groundwater of more than 200,000 people who live around the Union Carbide factory premises today. Even the factory was shut down back in 1984, and Dow Chemical, its owner, continues to refuse to clean up its toxic waste. The groundwater has extremely toxic chemicals, which is known to cause damage to lungs and livers and cause birth defects. And for all of this, you know, if you look at the look at what the perpetrators have gotten, they have given $500 as compensation to the Bhopal gas victims for lifelong injuries. They used their political clout, including that of Henry Kissinger. They were able to get the Indian government to accept a settlement that only costed them 43 cents per share. Not a single individual, not a single corporation official has gone to jail even for a minute for killing 25,000 people and for gassing 500,000 people in the half of the city of Bhopal. So this being the 40th anniversary, people of Bhopal and Bhopal survivors have come to U.S. to talk about not only what continues to happen in Bhopal, but also to draw connections with people living in U.S., people living on the fence line communities, people who are marginalized due to caste, class, race, or religion, who live around incinerators and who live around chemical production factories, to say that we all live in Bhopal and that we should not be part of these sacrifice zones. And to also say that we are all victims of corporate crimes, and unless and until there is justice in Bhopal, unless and until this precedent is changed, where you can come and kill and pollute, disable the next generation and pay $500, change your name from Union Carbide to Dow Chemical and get away with murder, we are all at risk of losing our health and our right to a healthy environment.
Yes, thank you. And I think, I don't know, but is Dow centered in Houston?
So Dow is headquartered in Midland, Michigan. But Dow has, we just visited their plant, Union Carbide and Dow plant in Seadrift, Texas, where they make polypropylene. And now they're planning to basically put in four nuclear reactors there. We met Diane Bilson, who is this, who is a seventh generation fisherwoman who has been fighting Union Carbide and Dow Chemicals poisoning in her own backyard in Seadrift, Texas. So they have, it's a transnational corporation. So they have chemical facilities in Louisiana. We went there, and in the Cancer Alley, they have a very big presence. In Houston, they have a huge presence, and all over the world. And they continue, you know, to say and repeat this lie over and over again that it would somehow become the truth that they did not operate the Union Carbide factory, and yet they cannot be held liable. Well, they took all the assets, and they cannot not say that they will not take its liabilities. They have assumed Union Carbide's liability in U.S. When it came to asbestos, and then they continue to have this complete double standard and tell us that $500 is plenty good for an Indian. So this racism towards people of Bhopal, people of color, people, you know, from a different country has to stop. And this is no different of what we have been seeing here. I mean, we visited East Houston area yesterday, and I was shocked to see how within this hub of factories where the flare towers are burning, where the gases are being emitted in the air, there are houses and communities of color and churches of people of color around these areas. And this is apparently all business and as usual, because people who live here are considered indispensable.
Right. So this tour that you're doing across America, can you talk about that? Especially, I'd like to go back to what you saw with Diane Wilson and Seadrift.
You know, Diane is a long-term supporter of the Bhopal campaign, and that is because, you know, one of the very few things that this country, the U.S. got as a result of the Bhopal disaster is this right to know. That means people in America now have the right to know what is being emitted in air, water, and land, right? And they got this because of the Bhopal disaster. And that is how Diane got involved in 1989 when she first heard about that the county that she was in had one of the most amount of factories, and because of that, there was the most amount of pollution. Diane is, again, also a Goldman Environmental Prize winner of 2023, and she has taken on this corporate giant, Union Carbide and Dow Chemical, which is now planning to build all these nuclear reactors in Seadrift, Texas. And I think it is not just about Dow. You know, there's Formosa Plastics and other chemical companies as well. But, you know, what we know that Bhopal is not isolated by geography or by location, right? What has happened in Bhopal in terms of deflecting responsibility, this is not something only new to Union Carbide and Dow Chemical. This is a common practice which persists across many industries and companies. And that is why, you know, we say that almost all of us on the planet are victims of corporate crime. And Diane is fighting there so that people in Seadrift know what these chemical corporations are doing to the health and environment.
Right, and to our air so much, and also the false solutions that are being put out to say that there's some sort of green technology that's coming in to help protect us, which we understand as being false and even laughable.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And I find it hard to, you know, believe that we are having debates about whether it is okay to permit any corporation emit carcinogenic chemicals in the air and what permissible limit should one be allowed at. You know, this is the most ridiculous, you know, argument. I mean, if one has to just look at the latest Lancet Commission report on pollution and human health, which basically says 9 million people die each year from industrial pollution. And the toxic reach of the petrochemical industry is not restricted to human exposure, but spans the entire globe and includes thousands of species of birds and mammals and reptiles that we don't even talk about, you know, that we don't even yes. address. But in all of this, you know, chemicals are proven innocent and, you know, are looked at innocent until proven guilty. Yeah. And that is what people in Bhopal have been struggling. In this process, the judiciary robs them of their dignity, where they have to prove that they have been victimized by this certain poison, whereas Union Carbide gets to, and Dow Chemical gets to walk free and say, oh, it was not us. But it is the victims who have to prove over and over again. And whether it is Bhopal or East Houston or the Cancer Alley in Louisiana where we have visited, nothing really has changed.
Can you talk about what you saw when you went to what's known as the Cancer Alley across Louisiana?
Yeah, what we were just astounded by, you know, I am accompanied by two of the Bhopal survivors, and they kept on asking me, is this America? Is this America? And because they have a totally different notion of what America is. What we saw was, again, communities of color who earlier worked on plantations are now being surrounded by these petrochemical industries. And every time there is a leak, there is an emission, there is a fire, they have to fend for themselves. What we have also seen that the agencies whose job it is to monitor pollution are not doing it, whether it is in India or whether it is in U.S. We saw in the Cancer Alley that there is high level of emissions that EPA is not reporting, but independent researchers like from John Hopkins Public Health are reporting. It is called Cancer Alley for a reason. You know, there is research that says that there is a disproportionate rate of cancers and endocrine disrupting diseases in that area. But again, what we saw over and over again, that it was mostly people of color or people who are marginalized through the class and caste status bear the burdens of these corporate crimes.
Right. You won't see these entities near million-dollar home neighborhoods.
And what we know that because of Bhopal, that consequences of this continue to manifest for decades after the event and are often passed down to the next generation. I mean, look at the case of Forever Chemicals, which is so popular now. It's a classic example of criminal behavior across multiple geographies and generations. I mean, we have documents that reveal that 3M knew about the public health dangers of Forever Chemicals used in fabrics or cookware and many other consumer goods, but buried the findings and continue to produce PFAS. Is that not criminal behavior? Is that not murder of people? But you will hardly see any convictions of these crimes, almost net zero convictions of any of these crimes happen.
And how's your reception been at these events that you've been doing across the country?
It's been very powerful. It's been very powerful to listen to people from the fence line communities on how they have been fighting this. What I know, what we know, Bhopal is not just a story of fight of 40 years, but there have been victories also because people have continued to fight. And it's the tenacity and persistence of the Bhopal survivors, which is a powerful testimony to the ability of people to defend their fundamental rights to a healthy environment. And the corporations who might seem invincible, it is only the power of a collective power of ordinary people, you know, who have held them to account. And to see so many people fight for that, it is very humbling and also very encouraging. And we hope to also meet with some maybe U.S. lawmakers and university students, so because there is a lot that can be done in Bhopal by providing legal, scientific, technical, medical, and other support, which is very critical in the victory of people's power.
Again, that was Rachna Dhingra, coordinator of the International Campaign for Justice in Bhopal, interviewed by Jacqueline Batisse, producer of People of Earth on KPFT in Houston. The International Campaign is meeting with federal lawmakers seeking to designate December 3rd, the 40th anniversary of the disaster, as Chemical Disaster Awareness Day. The campaign is also working with progressive U.S. groups on a nationwide week of solidarity with Bhopal on December 3rd to 10th. For more information and to get involved, visit bhopal.net. That's bhopal.net. I'm Bob Lederer at WBAI.
बात है दिल में फिर जला लो वही आसमां झुक रहा है तेरी राहों में छू ले तू अब इसे
That was Soon Zara from the film Bhopal, A Prayer for Rain. This is Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm Paulina Vasilyev. U.S.-funded Kenyan mercenary troops are currently on the ground in Haiti, the first black republic to free itself from slavery 220 years ago. J.R. Valray of Block Report Radio talked to Pierre Labossière of the Haiti Action Committee about the history of Haiti and how we got to this point.
A few months back, the international news reported Kenyan soldiers landed in Haiti, funded by the U.S. and U.N., supposedly to bring order to the nation after the 2021 assassination of U.S. puppet president Moses. Can you tell us a little bit about the history leading up to this mercenary force coming into Haiti? And can you just basically give the people a synopsis of history on how we got to this point?
Yes, this is a redo of the 2004 coup d'etat, kidnapping coup d'etat against President Aristide. And this is a little bit of the history of that. Back in 2004, February 29th, 2004, the U.S., France, and Canada, the three of them led. They had their special forces come into the private home of President Aristide and kidnap him and his wife, and along with one of their bodyguards. They kidnapped them to take them to the Central African Republic, and from there to remove them from office. And that led to the removal also of a lot of thousands of elected officials. We are talking from members of parliament down to prime minister, and even at the local level of mayors and city council members who were duly elected by the Haitian population. Why did this take place? It's because the Fermi-Lavalas government of President Aristide was implementing a pro-people agenda. What do I mean by that? They were, for the first time, I would say for one of the very few times in our history, where they were using the tax money of the people and the resources of Haiti to invest in education, to build schools, to build hospitals, to have sources of clean drinking water for the population, also engaging in integrating, in destroying Haitian apartheid. Because in Haiti, there is an apartheid system, and many people are not aware of that. And this is unspoken generally, but this system excludes the majority of the Haitian population, which is generally impoverished because of systemic injustices in the economic system, which keeps the majority of the population out of the mainstream, really, of enjoying their tax money. So basically, when we look at things like the money that France extorted from Haiti to compel us to pay reparations to the former slave owners, and I hate that term, but I'll put it in quotes, and that money came from the taxes that the mass of the peasant population had to pay, exorbitant taxes, for over a century in order to pay those people who had exploited their ancestors to pay them reparations, you see. And this money, it's the equivalent of $21.7 billion, as calculated in 2003. Done by President Aristide, who wanted to sue France, and he was serious about doing that, to get back that money to the Haitian people. And so these are the things, that's why the Aristide, the Fermi-Lavalas, led by President Aristide government, was so hated, and that coup d'etat had taken place. You see, because it was implementing a new system for Haiti to destroy the exclusion that had been, since independence, perpetrated against the majority population. And with exclusion, which I mean by that, apartheid. So in Haiti, there were many things like that that the Lavalas government was implementing. And so the U.S., France, and Canada were very clear. France didn't want this talk of reparations, of restitution, first the money that they stole. Then there was another bill, which is reparations for the crimes of slavery, for the kidnapping of our ancestors. The U.S. really wanted to eliminate it. It was together with France, because that talk, they didn't want it to be talked about in Haiti by the Fermi-Lavalas government in coalition with many Caribbean and African countries. So that had to be eliminated. This poor people agenda couldn't be allowed to be implemented in Haiti. Plus, also, you had the oligarchy. This is a small ruling elite in Haiti that thrives on exploiting. They have sweatshops and exploitation labor. Many of those sweatshops are subsidiaries. Actually, they are the factories owned really by people, by big textile folks in the U.S. and other enterprises, and exploitation labor. So they use the local wealthy, the ruling elite, to carry out this exploitation, very similar to the way it was during slavery days, when you had outside forces really owning the plantations in the country, in the colony, and then exploiting the labor of the people. So the Aristide government started implementing increasing the minimum wage to make it a livable wage for the population. And so all of this angered the U.S. State Department, it angered the Bush administration, and they wanted to eliminate that government. Thirdly, another reason is the natural resources of Haiti. Haiti has oil, Haiti has gold, Haiti has copper, bauxite, which aluminum is made, uranium, iridium, and the Fermi-Lavalas government wanted to make exploitation of those resources to benefit the Haitian population, something that the Canadians, the U.S., and France, they didn't want to hear. They would rather have puppets like Papa Doc Duvalier, Baby Doc Duvalier, or Martelly, or Ariel Henry, those folks who would allow them to steal the resources of the country, those folks who would allow them to pay starvation wages to the workers and not enforce the labor laws, the environmental laws, which the Aristide government was determined to enforce and to make sure that Haitian people would live a life of dignity. So these are a lot of the reasons for the coup. And so what we had, they brought in the UN, the United Nations forces, because the Haiti no longer had an army. That army was used to repress the population, and President Aristide, listening to the demands of the Haitian population, that they eliminated that army. And so what you had is the UN forces were there to make sure that the coup d'etat, the aftermath of the kidnapping, that they would enforce the coup d'etat and put back in power people who had been defeated at the polls by the Haitian population, who had voted in 2000 to put Fermi Lavalas in office. And so they put them in power. And since that time, for the past 20-plus years, since 2004 to the present, this has been the situation. Now, the Kenyan troops, they are there. I think now it's 400 of them. They were talking about a force of 2,500. Now they total 400. And they are in the country simply to carry out what the previous UN troops had been doing, which is to repress the population, to maintain control, to keep the status quo going, and that's the aim of this thing. And so people in Haiti, we are very opposed to it, and I'm so glad that people in Kenya, in several countries in Africa, and in the Caribbean are standing with the Haitian people in opposition to this.
Can you talk about the recent protests at the Haiti Liberté publication in NYC, where people were protesting this character, Barbecue, being heralded as a Haitian revolutionary? Who is Barbecue, and why is this publication and other media organizations trying hard to make this propaganda of him being a Haitian revolutionary stick?
You see, and again, this follows the pattern, taking it back again to the preparation of the coup of 2004. They had a fellow named Guy Philippe. Guy Philippe was a former member of the Haitian military, a young officer, who the U.S. took him and several of his colleagues, and they trained him during the period of the coup d'etat of 2004. He was trained in Ecuador at a military school run by the U.S. The U.S. is very involved in that. And they gave him training and then returned him to Haiti. Actually, that was during the first coup d'etat, my apologies, during the mid-90s. And so this man, who was trained by them, was actually very involved in drug trafficking, he and his cohorts. And so what they did was they were the ones who were part of the coup d'etat. They didn't have the strength to do it. They were trained in the Dominican Republic, and they were being heralded at that time. And I'm talking about, again, my apologies, I'm talking about the mid to late 90s, all the way to 2004. They were being heralded. There was much propaganda, same as we are witnessing today with Barbecue, that they were revolutionaries and everything else. It was all State Department orchestrated propaganda. And so this guy was a killer. Later on, in the year 2017, he was arrested because the scandal became too much, that he was involved in drug trafficking and everything. So they put him in jail he was supposed to spend 9 years in jail, but he ended up spending 7. And he was just released, and all of a sudden, he's leading a revolution in Haiti, which the Haitian people do not believe in, don't buy, are completely disgusted with that. This brings us to Barbecue, because it's the same pattern. Barbecue joined, his name is Jimmy Cherizier, and he joined the Haitian police in the wake of the 2004 coup d'etat. He was trained, again, by the U.S. as part of an elite corps, the U.S. UN troops. But then he became so vicious in his attack against the population that in 2017 his name first surfaced as being part of a police-organized massacre in Grand Ravine. And a school was attacked, and several staff of the school, and including the cook and the janitor, the caretaker, they were massacred horribly. So about 11 people were killed in this massacre. A year later, in November, he participated in the massacre of people in the community of La Saline. And this massacre, La Saline is a very poor Lavalas neighborhood in Port-au-Prince, where people are very determined and people were protesting against the conditions, the extreme atrocious conditions of living in their communities. And so in order to quiet them down, he was part of a massacre that took place in that community. And it's been estimated that over 200 people were killed in this massacre. There is a report by the National Lawyers Guild from San Francisco, a joint report with the Haiti Action Committee, where we went and investigated this massacre that took place and wrote a report about it. People can find it on the National Lawyers Guild website. It's called the La Saline Massacre, La Saline, L-A-S-A-L-I-N, Massacre. And Barbecue Jimmy Cherizier is named in that. And by the way, the name Barbecue, despite all of the cover-up that's been taking place, he got this name, this surname, by setting people on fire after he had killed them, and according to many sources, while the people are still alive. And so that's one thing about this guy. So he's a really terrible individual who was continuing on the La Saline massacre. It became too much, so the police had to remove him from the force. But he has always bragged that he maintains good relations with the police, that he has, and I've seen videos of him with a police escort, even though there was a warrant for his arrest. None of that was ever executed. As a matter of fact, he's been giving interviews, having working freely with police escort, police in uniform, escorting him, you see. And this has been going on and on and on. So now here comes Haiti Liberté. Haiti Liberté is a well-known publication that has been advocating, saying that Barbecue is a revolutionary. It was the same tactic that was used by the U.S. State Department and other places where they had people proclaiming that Guy Philippe was a revolutionary. And so, same thing, we see it's a redo of this. And we are seeing some people who are very gullible, or I would say don't know the realities of Haiti, repeating that. Why? Because the guy has a beret in a submachine gun in his hand, and then he's quoting Che Guevara, he's citing their names, even calls Malcolm X's name. And so this grouping, a man named Kim Ives, another one, we've had Chris Edges also being part of this, and another one named Dan Cohen, who've been putting out there that he's a revolutionary. But all of that is to confuse people, is to create a lot of confusion so that the people who are actually torturing, setting schools on fire, the Barbecue leads this network of gangs. They are called, and I call them death squads. They used to call them G9. Now they changed the name of Vivre Ensemble, Living Together. And what they do is destroy those neighborhoods where the impoverished families are living, where they are trying to make a living by selling sodas, selling food. And it goes through their neighborhoods, destroys those neighborhoods, sets fire to the houses, including whether the people are residents or not, people are set on fire. His network of death squads gang rape women. Even little children are killed. There are several articles that we have issued around that. And not only us, but other voices in Haiti on social media. There are videos too horrible to be posted online. But the victims themselves, the Haitian people, the survivors, they make videos when these things are happening. And they share it with the Haitian community, urging us to let the world know what's going on. And to see this guy, Kim Ives, who leads Haiti Liberté, that publication, going out there on Amy Goodman's show, on other programs like that, proclaiming that Barbecue is a revolutionary, this has outraged the Haitian community. And this is why you are seeing people protesting him, the publication, and this is what's going on.
That was Pierre Labossière of the Haiti Action Committee speaking to J.R. Valray of Block Report Radio. The Haiti Action Committee can be found at HaitiSolidarity.net, and a companion organization can be found at HaitiEmergencyRelief.org.
Hang on to the world as it spins around. Down. Things are moving fast.
That was Donny Hathaway, Someday We'll All Be Free. U.S. healthcare workers have been mobilizing against the genocide in Gaza. On Friday, September 5th, rallies took place around the world and in the U.S. to remember the healthcare workers killed and injured in Gaza and the West Bank. San Francisco union activist Elizabeth Milos spoke to Pacifica's Steve Zeltzer about how the AFL-CIO works with the Israeli Zionist Trade Federation Histadrut to suppress pro-Palestinian voices in the labor movement, including her own union, UPTI, the Union of Professional and Technical Employees at the University of California.
Our resolution that's here from UPTI, which was passed by the executive board in June 2021, included breaking ties with Histadrut. And this present leadership of UPTI took it off of the website.
And this idea of business unionism in this country, there's no real opposition by the national unions against the trillions of dollars that are going to war. They separate business union contract negotiations with actually the war spending, which seems unlimited to support Israel, genocide in Gaza. What do you think about that whole issue of basically not taking up the issue of U.S. imperialism, U.S. war machine?
Well, it goes all the way back to the AFL-CIO's involvement in intervention in countries in Latin America, which continues to this day through the Solidarity Center. So many people don't want to look at that. They don't want to look at that level of involvement, that how embedded we are within. I mean, the whole construction is happening here today by the Helen Diller Foundation. Helen Diller Foundation is one of the major contributors to Canary Mission, the same Canary Mission that's attacking Denise Camargo.
Right. What is the Canary Mission?
It's an organization by Israel that is set up to dox and to expose and to call, falsely claim people that criticize Israel as anti-Semitic and destroy their academic life, their professional lives by getting them fired, basically, which is what happened to Denise. I don't have any evidence to support the Canary Mission directly was involved in the firing of Denise, but I you can pretty much surmise it if you think about who the major donors are of the UC system.
And what role do they play in the university, the Diller Foundation and other wealthy supporters of Israel, Zionists?
They recently, last November I think it was, where they had the Elia Carr, there was Zionists who were actually presented and made presentations here. They've been claiming that students who are Jewish are feeling threatened. There's been no threats to any Jewish students at all. In fact, we, as you can see, there was a lot of participation of Jewish Voice for Peace, and millions of Jews nationwide have been at marches and demonstrations against Israeli apartheid and against the genocide.
And it seems like for American working people, the choice, the major choices, the Democrats and Republicans both have a policy of supporting Israel, and they say that they're Zionist. I mean, Harris says she's a Zionist, and she spoke at AIPAC. She supports Israel and this genocide, and they even refused to have one Palestinian American speak at the Democratic Convention while they had Zionists speak there. What does that say about the political reality that American working people are facing?
It basically says that it's not leaving Americans with many choices when it comes to voting, and that we definitely need a united front for a Labor Party in order to be able to have an alternative to this Democratic Party and Republican Party, so-called lesser of two evils, when in reality they're the same ruling party, the same ones that are doing this, you know, basically.
And the Histadrut, which the AFL-CIO is affiliated to, recently had a general strike in Israel. They say that they want a ceasefire. What's the nature of the Histadrut, the relationship of the AFL-CIO to the Histadrut?
Well, first of all, the general strike that the Histadrut was presenting was had to do only with about the Israeli hostages and the fact that they had found six of them dead. It also has to do with the fact that Israel is suffering economically because of the war, and so that, of course they want the war to end, but not in the same way that Palestinians want the war to end. The Histadrut has has been giving 400 shekels a month to the IDF reservists. So in essence, they're doing a general strike to have the war end, but they're paying the IDF reservists 400 shekels a month out of union dues, may I add. History Doodle has been involved in the creation of the Israeli state from the beginning, from the 1920s, when it received funding from the American Federation of Labor. This was even before the establishment of the Israeli state. So there's a long history of collusion, illegal collusion, of land theft, apartheid, and now genocide against the Palestinians by the American labor movement as well as by the U.S. government.
And UPTI is affiliated with the CWA. What's the role of the CWA